Welcome to the 1CA podcast. This is your host, Jack Gaines. 1CA is a product of the Civil Affairs Association and brings in people who are current or former military, diplomats, development officers, and field agents to discuss their experiences on ground with the partner nation's people and leadership. Our goal is to inspire anyone interested in working the last 3 feet of foreign relations. To contact the show, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com or look us up on the Civil Affairs Association website at www.civilaffairsassoc.org. I'll have those in the show notes.
The only area of Germany where there was a lot of continued hostility towards British and Americans because of their bombing was in fact East Germany, which had not been occupied by Americans and Britons, but by the Soviets.
Recently, I partnered with SMA to talk with Professor Beatrice Hauser on post-conflict stabilization. What you will hear on this show is the edited version. If you wish to listen to the full uncut version, I will have a link to it in the show notes. This is part 2 of 2, so enjoy.
So it's interesting that the fact that people then got to know real Americans and real British people on the ground meant that they dissociated the bombing with the people that occupied them. The occupation forces were pretty harsh in many areas. They kept discipline among the population, etc., but also could be seen to be quite fair. There was little inter-societal hatred in Germany. The occupation forces had the strength that they could distribute the food. And of course, very soon after that came martial aid. And very quickly, Germans felt more prosperous. They felt they were getting out of the misery of the war itself. And by 1948, when you had the Berlin blockade, so very soon after the war, everybody moved their attention from Germany as the old enemy, the enemy that might stand up again, to a new enemy. And the public was much more focused on the Soviet Union, and Germany turned in a very short period of time into a potential future ally. So it was a very particular situation, and it's important to keep in mind that there's no universal recipe that can be deduced from any of these, particularly not when you want to transfer them to countries without democratic experience, countries that don't see themselves as entirely defeated, countries where there are leaders in exile that will go against the occupation forces' policies. And particularly when you have very small occupation forces that can't really relate culturally with the language, etc., when there is no new enemy that can just detract the attention, and when there is no economic foundations for a quick turnaround into a prosperous country. And now comes a really, really difficult issue. It's enormously difficult, but I think central to what we're seeing, not so much in Ukraine, but very, very much in Gaza. And that is the question of innocent civilians. As you know, the Israelis have a different perception of what an innocent civilian is. And for the Israelis, even those who are just hiding arms or carrying a missile from A to B, something like that, are seen not as innocent civilians. If we remind you that the innocent, meaning one who does not harm, to what extent do all those who protect Hamas, to what extent are they not doing harm to Israel? And the Israelis see them as also contributing to the harm. And this question of how innocent civilians are goes back again to Nazi Germany, when the majority of people voted for Hitler, even in the last 3 elections. To what extent can you say that people who voted for Hitler therefore had absolutely nothing to do with what then happened? There are different categories, I would put it to you. There are those who really cannot do any harm. There are the citizens of a totalitarian system who might be willy-nilly contributing to a war effort simply because they might be afraid that they'd be put behind bars if they don't do sort of minimum of contributing. Then there are those who are somehow voluntarily enhancing the war effort, those who are actually the combatants. So for the present discussion, leave aside the question of whether it is physically possible, if in war, to differentiate between the 4 categories. And nevertheless, because one could take from that that there are degrees of responsibility. Those who voted for a party that had already proclaimed war to be its aim, are they really innocent of what that political party does once in government? Those who do not protest against the government as it embarks on a war during its tenure of office, to what extent are they innocent? those who morally support such a government's war surely are not entirely innocent. And then there are those who are actively supporting this government's work by working in the economy, in the defense sector itself. And I'd just like to confront you with two different views on this, both curiously by women, one of them being this early 15th century person I've mentioned to you before, Christine de Pizan. This is in the context of the Hundred Years' War between the King of France and the King of England, both wanting to be King of France. And she somehow assumed that the populations affected by the war had some sort of choice of either supporting the King of France or supporting the King of England. She was on the side of France. And so she said, see, if the subjects of the King of England do nothing to support the King of England, we shouldn't harm them. But if they support their own king, then we can pillage their houses, we can take them prisoner, we can seize whatever we can find. And this curiously supposes that in the early 15th century, people had the choice of whether to support their local king or the king of the area in which they lived, or to come over to the other side. So this idea of a democratic choice is quite surprising. To the contrary, there was a Catholic philosopher at Oxford University, G.M. Anscombe, thought that you could differentiate in war between those who are not fighting, not engaged in supplying those who are with the means of fighting. A farmer growing wheat, which may be eaten by the troops, is not supplying them with means of fighting. So she thought you could really differentiate between those who are fighting and those who are not. And anybody contributing to the war effort should be seen as civilian and innocent, therefore. And she was very strongly against the bombing, to which she owed her chair in Oxford because people admired so much that she went against the entire mood of the time. Interestingly, in the Potsdam Conference, and I'm already coming towards the end of my talk, when this is about settlement of Germany after the Second World War, the Allied countries came together and talked about what they wanted to do with Germany. They want to punish the Germans. And they came up with the idea that the German people have begun to atone for the terrible crimes committed under the leadership of the Nazis, to whom they gave open approval and blind obedience in the hour of their success. Yet it was not in the intention of the Allies to destroy or enslave the German people. It was their intention to give the German people the opportunity to prepare themselves to rebuild their lives later on a democratic and peaceful basis. But as I've already said, this was possible in Germany because the way of life were already there. But you see how the people were thinking about that nexus between how they had approved of and in blind obedience obeyed the Nazi regime. And I'll just point out, without condoning it, that this is also the argument made by Islamist terrorists inciting Muslims the world over to kill Americans and their allies because they had supported governments who in turn had been slaughtering Palestinian people or slaughtered the children of Iraq. This is why the American people are not innocent. The American people are active members in all these crimes, said Osama bin Laden, in inciting people to use violence for them. We've also found a British IR theorist, Barry Buzan, in the context of the Kosovo War and the bombing of Serbia. The problem is, in the democracies, electors get the government that they deserve. The Serbians turned themselves into human civilian shields by occupying key bridges in order to prevent NATO from blowing them up. He thought they were legitimate targets. And another philosopher, David Luban, brought up this idea of war as a punishment. Democratic states may be even more collectively guilty of international crimes than undemocratic ones, precisely because their regimes rely more heavily on popular support. But we, he thought, should reject the conception of collective guilt that can lead to the death of maiming or loss of possession of anyone in a guilty population. Nevertheless, injustice arises from the fact that the disasters of war are distributed among the enemy population without regard to their individual guilt. So this throws up really, really difficult questions about the guilt and the innocence of civilians. Has it ever worked to put pressure on civilians to overthrow their governments? And so in what circumstances? I'm not sure it has. Do we consider Russian citizens innocent of Putin's war? What nonviolent means could one use to increase numbers of Russians opposing Putin? Would limited violence be warranted? And finally, what other legitimate ways could be found to exert pressure on civilian populations with the political result we want, namely a rebellion against the government? But that really goes beyond the question of the post-conflict stabilization that I've been given. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. That was excellent. And I appreciate that you brought up the three questions that I had sent you as a preamble, because that's three questions I don't have to ask directly in the Q&A session. So it'll make it a lot easier. Mariah, are you unmuted?
Yes, I'm standing by. Yep.
All right, great. So I come from a civil affairs community. Our job and goal is to take people who don't want to be in a conflict out of the battle space. But with issues like Hamas and Palestine, to pull everyone out of Gaza so that they can figure out a solution is tough.
And that gets back to this question that David Luban put up, which is, you know, if it were possible to differentiate, that would be nice. But if you can't, the wrong people are suffering.
Right.
And this is the conundrum that you can't distinguish, particularly not in bombing, not with the technology we have today, between the people who are really guilty. We have horrible examples of the Second World War, of course, you know, people of hiding Jews being killed in the Hamburg firestorm, or American prisoners of war being killed in Nagasaki. The wrong people are then suffering from what you're trying to do. So we don't have the means of discrimination at the moment. And at the same time, it's quite likely that people who feel neutral and are innocent at that stage are going to feel more strongly, move to the other side when they feel that they have been wronged and they have been bombed and they've been treated very badly in that war. So this is why I was emphasizing the importance of the treatment even while the war is still on.
Right. And I can only imagine Hamas's reaction if we pulled up with four cruise ships to take the population out of there. They would probably fire on the cruise ships and the public who was trying to cross, because they want everyone in the fight. So to address what I feel is a market gap in post-conflict stabilization for the military, and we discussed this earlier in the warm-up, and that is General Petraeus went to Carnegie, and he talked about when he was a division commander in Kuwait and his preparation for going into Iraq to overthrow the government, that when he asked, what is the goals of post-conflict? And they said, well, leave that to us. We'll take care of it, which is wholly inadequate. And that's what he said as well. And the reason is we need to know the post-conflict strategy and the end states, the goals that we want to achieve in order to drive the conflict to those goals, as well as we achieve post-conflict standards, to manage that post-conflict environment so that they can be successful. As you were saying, with dealing with people who are populists that want to rise up and build that government versus those who are opportunists that want to derail it for their own good, and others, people who are criminals that want to take advantage of the chaos in between to further their personal gains. Have you seen any clear indications of how a force that's working either with a country to build stability or manage conflict, or like in Afghanistan and Iraq, have actually flipped a government and they're trying to build stability? Do you see any ways in which they can manage the population in a way to spot the people who are trying to actually do the right thing versus those who are not?
So one of the things that comes up a time and again is in the writings on counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency in particular, or intervention in such wars in particular, when you're dealing with a criminal regime and the population going along with that regime. And the criminal regime we see as criminal, the population may not yet at that stage see it as criminal. One of them is really, really important. It comes back again and again. It comes to the idea of the trial of the leaders. And make sure that the population themselves understand fully that by the laws, ideally of their own society, their regime was criminal. That's a very, very good first step. And this is why there's been all this criticism of the Nuremberg and the Tokyo trials, that they said, well, this is victor's justice. People could have been tried by some of the crimes of their own legislation. So make sure that the leaders are seen as criminals by these trials. Don't make them martyrs. That's actually a very nice one. I don't know to what extent people listening here have ever heard about Beethoven's Egmont Overture. Egmont was a leader of the Dutch rebellion against the Spanish, and he was executed in Brussels Square, the main big square that every NATO person knows, that is, you know, the big beautiful square in Brussels. Egmont became martyrs because they were executed but not tried properly, and the population didn't see them as criminals. They were seen as martyrs. And this is something that Santa Cruz de Maldonado had in mind when he said, do not make enemy rebel leaders martyrs. Make sure that they're seen as criminals, treat them fairly and justly, give them a trial. So that's one. The other one is, and this has worked for a number of different cultures, it's the amnesty for the many. A quotation goes all the way back to Livy, which says you can either kill the entire population, which is not very realistic, or you must pardon them. So this difference between the big population, the mass of the population, and the criminal leaders, pardon the rest, bring them over to their side by clemency and forgiving. And make it quite clear that you're doing this because you need them. You're being benign and you showing yourself in a benign role. Footnote to that. One of the things that I've been regretting all along, as we're talking about very concrete cases here, particularly with regard to Israeli responses to the 7th of October tragedy, is that they haven't made much more of a show of doing something positive for the population of Gaza. The point is, we're living in a world of media presence and spin doctors, etc., but I see no effort of this, no effort at all of, say, rescuing people in hospitals. It only very lately have we've seen any aid given to hospitals, and the very recent food aid that ended in disasters that we had last week. It seems to be very exceptional. So for months and months, they could have been doing this, even if it was just done in very small amounts. You could have made so much more out of it if that had happened. So do something and make a lot of publicity over it. The Marshall's aid was an enormous success, not only because it happened in very large quantity, but because every single pack of flour said, this is where Marshall aid helps, Marshall aid for you. It was a huge propaganda thing. And propaganda, I think, is very important in this context.
I think propaganda gets undersold on these type of issues, especially with the aid delivery. It seemed like it was almost staged to look bad, depending on which camera angle you came from. But most of what I see coming out of areas like Gaza is that people are trying to create the visibility to support the operation versus what you're talking about, shifting populations from being in total support to either being neutral or even those in the neutral getting out of the way. So, Maria, I saw you unmuted. You got something?
Yeah, a couple of things came up in this idea of talking about the idea of biases and the narratives. We all have biases in our reporting to support our own narratives. How do we rely on these different kind of reports, whether it's from the hospitals or do we have UN observers from NGOs? How does this play into the overall narrative and how we look at these?
A problem that has clearly become worse with modern technology, but one which is not altogether new. Rumors have been the enemy of every army that was trying to pacify an area since time immemorial. You know, there's been rumors of a massacre about to happen when the occupation of power was simply benign. So it's not an altogether new thing, but how to verify and to be sure that information you get is actually accurate is, I think, one that you have to leave to technologists that are much more knowledgeable about this than I am. But it's clearly a huge problem.
We got Mariah.
First, I want to throw out a question from Dr. Todd Beasy. So he said, the 1945 conditions and context is important, and as you said, exceptional. Many inside the U.S. and abroad continue to hold firmly the notion of hyperpower, perhaps greatly exaggerating its ability to succeed. So this very principle is weighing heavily in our presidential election, as many citizens hold the U.S. president can drive the course of wars in Ukraine and Gaza. Do we need to reframe our understanding about the derivation and application of power to match the reality of increasing power diffusion in this century?
Thank you very, very much for that very, very incisive question. It's happening. First of all, if you look at all the national security strategies that has come out over the last couple of years, all of them seem to have taken a step back from the idea that was there so strongly after 1945, that we can change the world in our image and ultimately everybody will be democracies, an idea that, of course, had a big surge after the Soviet Union collapse at the beginning of the 1990s. And I think there was a lot of optimism, even so far that you had this extraordinary text that was adopted by NATO when ISAF took charge of Afghanistan in 2003, which was to say that they were trying to make Afghanistan a democratic and self-sustaining government. There is no trace of this any longer in more recent documents. And I was interested to see that, for example, this Allied Joint Doctrine for the Military Contribution of Stabilization, the word elections or the word democracy are not mentioned. So I think we've taken a step back from that. And I think that ambition that was probably always overambitious. And how to reframe is the question, and the reframing is in part already in that document, I think admirably, to say one tries to have something that is seen as legitimate by the population there, a government that is legitimate in the eyes of its own population. And as long as you can do that, you're already a lot better off than in a war with people tearing each other apart.
This is Jack. You know, that reminds me of Korea, Singapore, and in some parts, Colombia, which were successful in transitioning from conflict to post-conflict. And Singapore and Korea, they had dictators for a while that actually released power into a more democratic state. Rwanda is very similar to that too. Even though it's a one-party system, they do have some openings for opposition.
So I was also intrigued by talking about this idea of self-determination, but then also like getting into what is innocence. We only have a few minutes left, so I don't know how far we're going to get into it, but how important is self-determination? And I bring up the idea of these different levels, if you will, of innocence or how you determine that, because I've heard people say they voted in Hamas. And I'm not an expert, but if I remember correctly, there was either them or someone who was even more hated at the time. And also there was very low turnout.
And it was what, 20 years ago?
So what is this idea?
You can take it a step further and you can say that this was 2007. In 2007, to what extent could people of Gaza, what the Hamas was going to become like? I think a lot of people would tell you that they could have known, one could have known. But then take it further, 2007, a lot of the younger people around were either not born or definitely couldn't vote. So there's a lot of people who literally weren't responsible in this respect. And then you get to the next point, would you expect them now to turn over their neighbor's son, who they know is from Hamas? To what extent do you expect them to do this? Could they get away with it? Would the Hamas themselves punish them? Are they still in a situation to punish them? I mean, this was one of the things that was always said for Germany in the Third Reich. A lot of people who didn't do anything because they were so afraid for themselves. And again, this can be looked at very differently. And there's just so much research has been done on particularly the German society then. One of the things that research has shown is that very few Aryans were ever really killed and punished unless they were seen as communists. So there was a perception that they would be punished, that dreadful things would happen to them or their family, but it didn't necessarily happen. So does that mean that the perception was wrong? The perception was wrong, but still people acted under the fear that something would happen to them. To what extent can you work against that fear? So a horribly difficult area, but at the moment, very concrete terms, we're not sure that there are many people anywhere in Gaza who would be happy to cooperate with anybody bringing in food in a peaceful way.
So we are actually getting to the top of the hour. I want to turn the floor over to Jack, if you have any final questions, and then offer any last few minutes to Professor Huser.
I just want to thank you again, Professor, for coming on. I think that DOD has an opportunity through your talk to further its planning on conflict to post-conflict and transition. We need to get on it because the world needs it. The international community, the plan you had are a great start, but we have to do our homework on it and get prepared.
Yeah, I would say thank you very, very much for having had me. But I think this idea of the post-hostilities planning while hostilities are still being carried on is absolutely vital. And we've learned at the expense of lots and lots of lives and great disaster that we should have done so much more for Iraq, but also for Afghanistan. So I'm all with you there. Thank you very much again for having invited me.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you both. And everyone, thank you for joining us today. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks for listening. If you get a chance, please like and subscribe and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. Also, if you're interested in coming on the show or hosting an episode, email us at capodcasting@gmail.com. And now, most importantly, to those currently out in the field, working with a partner nation's people or leadership to forward U.S. relations, thank you all for what you're doing. This is Jack, your host. Stay tuned for more great episodes. 1CA Podcast.